Welcome to the Conspiracy Files. It made the national news and continued to be a big story for some time after that spring Sunday morning incident in 2002 when a tugboat captain evidently lost his mind, literally, and drove a barge into a span of a bridge over I-40. The incident happened in Oklahoma near Gore, where there just happens to be a nuclear waste dump. When we first started to do this story, a program that literally has been years in the making, we knew it had some elements of conspiracy that had to be addressed. Now, here we are in April of 2008. And we've been working on this story for several years with several producers and researchers. Roberta Scott, Jane Swartley, Larry Dickin, Adam Shannon, and Linda Jensen, who, by the way, has written a great spy novel based on the event called The Bridge Collapse Murder. We will be revealing all of the puzzling elements of this story, including the latest developments concerning one of the main players, one of the central figures of the incident, William C. Clark, a man who inserted himself into that story on that Sunday morning in the spring of 2002, a man of mystery. He later was sentenced to prison for impersonating an Army officer, and then he had his parole revoked just last week because of a strange incident involving Clark calling the Russian embassy and saying that he was part of an alleged conspiracy plot to assassinate President Putin of Russia. We have many questions and very few solid answers, but we do have the testimony of William Clark himself. He did an interview with us right after the Putin incident. Listen to this interview and see if it does not ring true with the other shows we have done on mind control. The MK Ultra program, for one, from the CIA, and others from the Defense Department. Why would William Clark, a man who has had, by all accounts, a very rough personal life, be used by anyone for anything? It is a puzzling question indeed, but our investigations show that in these mind control operations, they always seem to indicate someone who can be controlled, someone who's hearing voices in his head, has severe headaches, nightmares, missing time. They always seem to be happening to the losers in society. Could this be a grand scheme of the black ops, using only victims for instruments of their dirty deeds? Victims who have no accountability, who have no emotional stability. Unfortunately, it seems to be the case. Stay tuned. We'll be talking with William Clark. It's an amazing story. I'm sure you will agree.
The American Southwest, a land of abandoned stagecoach stops, crumbling ghost towns, obscure, overgrown wagon trails, all ghosts of an exciting and romantic past. But amidst the hogback ridges and desolate expanses of the Four Corners region, stories float about of secrets, whispers of extraterrestrial spacecraft, intruding galactic visitors from other worlds, underground facilities, and above top secret recovery operations. Come now on a journey through this prehistoric land as we visit several locations where some of the most guarded secrets of the modern age have alleged to unfold. Along the way, we will speak with some of the most respected investigators, reporters, authors, and lecturers in the field of UFO research.
the DVD that shows the mysteries that haunt the desert Southwest. Order Fallen Angels today from ShopJerryPippin.com. This is Jerry Pippin. Welcome to the Conspiracy Files, and we're broadcasting from Shadowwood Mall here in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and we have William C. Clark with us. If that name sounds familiar, if you've looked at our I-40 bridge segment on our Conspiracy Files, then you probably recognize him. He was the man who was convicted of being an imposter of a U.S. Army captain, I believe. We'll find out that story in a minute from William, since he's here. But basically, William, you served several years in the penitentiary for this offense, right?
Yes, that's correct, 70 months.
And you're back here in Muskogee. You never lived in Muskogee, though.
No, never.
That just one of the quirks, I guess, of the justice system. They want you where you were convicted. This is where the trial was.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk in detail about what happened and get your side of the story. You know, everybody and their brother has reported on this like they're a big expert. And I've been waiting for a chance to talk to you because I want to find out exactly what happened from the beginning to the end, if it's okay with you.
That's fine with me. I'm ready to tell my story.
But before we even start with that, let's give a little background about you personally. You were born in Texas. You were an Army brat at one time.
Yes.
Your father or stepfather or somebody was in the service.
My father's and my uncle's and my grandfather. And
So you you never really served in the service yourself?
No, I was in ROTC, and I've traveled all around the world with the military.
We'll talk about all that here in a minute when we get to the part about the bridge collapse. But you've been making a little news. I noticed AP here a while back had a story about you calling the Russian embassy. Is that true?
Unfortunately, yes, because of my medication.
Okay, by medications, what do you mean? What are you on?
I take Seroquel and I take Doxepin.
And what is this for? To relieve anxiety or what?
Seroquel is used to help with people with bipolar disorder, personality disorder, delusional disorder.
How long have you been diagnosed as bipolar?
Since right after I got arrested.
So you didn't have a history of any mental problems before that, emotional problems?
I had, but I never really did anything about it.
Yeah. So you're pretty well taking the word of the U.S. government. I guess they called you into your parole officer and said, hey, you call the Russian embassy, is that right?
Yeah, when I was in Oklahoma City and I got called up and to come in to see my probation officer. And when I showed up, there was an FBI agent there and a Secret Service agent.
And what happened? What'd they say?
They said that I called the Russian embassy with a plot to...
Now, this was October 25th or something?
Yeah, something like that, yes.
Reason I ask about that, there was a big plot about Vladimir Putin. That's who you said that there was the plot against, right?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about making that call at all?
I remember hearing voices and stuff about it, and I thought
hearing voices. What do you mean? Somebody saying, "William, go call."
No. I thought that I heard people's voices talking about a plot against the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, or whatever his name is. And I know how our government system is, and that's why I called the Russian embassy, and I told them what I heard.
So you heard these voices, and these voices were saying, do you remember what they were saying or anything? Were men's voices, women's voices,
it was
italic voices? What was it?
It was men's voices. They was talking about how they had someone that was close to him that was going to help take him out.
And the Russian embassy, of course, reported it to the FBI.
they reported it to the, I guess, the State Department or to the Secret Service.
And it went down the chain. And
then apparently this happened like on the 24th or 25th or something like that. And then the following day, I got called in. And I wasn't even given my rights or anything. They started giving me the drill. Started threatening me and everything.
By threatening, you mean like sending you back to prison? Or threatening you how?
Threatening by having me locked up, throwing away the key, making sure that I'd be buried, basically. That I would never see the light of day.
Now, why don't you tell our audience a little bit, before we go any further about this, how you got to be in Oklahoma City?
After I got released from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, the Federal Probation and Parole Office had denied me going to California to live with my mother because of the fact that the place that she lived was too small.
She lives in a small town in the desert.
Yes, and she was living in a trailer, in a mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
But they said,
well, everybody in the desert lives in a trailer almost, I'm kidding.
Well, about 80% of them, I'd say. But they wouldn't let me go there because of that reason. So it was mandatory that if
This is while you were serving your hard time in Victorville?
Yes. And they had denied that. And in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, if you don't have a relocation to a place, then you have to go back to the jurisdiction that sentenced you. And I had went to the halfway house in Oklahoma City.
You actually were sentenced over here in eastern Oklahoma, though.
Yes, but they don't have a halfway house for federal prisoners in the eastern district.
What goes on at a halfway house? We hear about that all the time. What's this? Is it a dormitory or something? Or is it apartments? Or what is it?
No, you have rooms. Some are two men. Some are four men. All depends on the halfway house, I'd imagine.
So you had a roommate?
I had three other roommates.
Okay, so you're in a room with four people?
Yes.
You have bunk beds or what?
Yes.
Okay.
And
kind of reminds me of my Army service. I always got the top bunk, but I'm not so sure that's the best deal.
No, not always. especially when you've done time in prison.
Yeah, right.
But in the halfway house and stuff,
Well,
not in the halfway house. They you have to get your identification and everything first, and then they go job searching.
And when they do this they sent you to Oklahoma City and they put you on a bus to send you there because I know you called me one time.
Yes,
because I was going to meet you originally.
Yeah, they put me on the bus from Victorville, California, to Oklahoma City.
Because originally we were going to go out to the prison and do the interview, but we decided it'd be best, since you were coming this way, just to wait.
Yes.
And then we decided it'd be better for you to be out and working, which you are now,
mm-hmm.
and trying to be a citizen. So we wanted to get away from any influences at all so you could tell your story.
Yes.
And so it's been a long road, but we finally made it.
Yeah, finally. Slowly but surely, we finally made it.
Okay, let's go back. Before I even go to the story, and we're going to go it step by step, if it's okay with you, for people, because if they look at our website, they see the I-40 bridge story, and they see all of the videos, and they see all of the things. They really need to know a little bit more about it from your side of the story.
Well, that's one side that was never told.
Well, we're telling it now.
Yeah.
And we'll get to that in a moment, but I just can't leave this calling the Russian embassy. That's so far out.
I couldn't believe it either. I've had incidents where I blacked out. Like one time back in like 94, 95, I was in Savannah, Georgia. And the next thing I know, I woke up in jail in New Orleans under a different name.
Was it weeks later, or?
It was probably about a week and a half, almost 2 weeks later.
You had a different name? You looked at your wallet and you had
I didn't have my wallet. I was in the jail in New Orleans.
Did they arrest you there for?
It was for, I don't remember now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But turned around and I was like, wait a second, what am I doing in jail? And they kept on calling me this Nichols person. I'm like, wait a second, that's not my name. They said, well, that's the name that you gave when you was arrested.
But you remember nothing about that?
I don't remember anything. All I know is that one moment I was in Georgia.
Now they sent you down to Fort Worth for a medical mental evaluation.
Yes.
You didn't stay very long.
Well, when I first went there, after I first got arrested, I stayed there for, I think it was about 47, 48 days.
That was before the trial.
Well, there was never a trial.
Well, we'll talk about that too right. When we get to it.
They found me incompetent and everything. And I come back and...
Well, they still tried you as a competent person.
Well, that's because the prosecution decided to move the time of the court hearing, made it earlier instead of the time that it was supposed to have been. Because the doctor that did the evaluation that found me incompetent...
Now, look, you're saying that the doctor's report was going to come out that you were incompetent, but they moved the trial up.
Right. And
so they could try you as a competent person?
No. What happened was that they turned around and ordered the record sealed. And they ordered a new competency hearing.
Now, who ordered the record sealed? The judge?
The courts, yes. The judge.
Was this here in Muskogee?
Yes.
And that was on probably a motion by the state. I mean, the feds.
Yes, by the federal prosecution office.
Okay, so we're getting ahead of the story. You went back after you called the Russian embassy.
Yes, and
do you think you really called a Russian embassy?
I'm not sure.
Reason I'm asking, I mean, you don't really remember that, do you?
Really, I don't.
You're just taking their word for it.
Exactly. I know what I was told by the feds.
You had a cell phone. Have you ever tried to look at the records?
It doesn't show on my cell phone. I don't know if they must have been erased by the feds when they got my phone. But,
Okay, so they called you in Oklahoma City where this actually happened.
Yes.
And the FBI lady, the investigator, was the Secret Service there at the time?
When I got arrested, there was an FBI agent there. There was another
At the moment of the arrest, or they came out to your apartment where you were living?
No, they didn't come to my apartment. I was contacted by my federal probation officer who had courtesy supervision for me for the Eastern District because I was living and working in Oklahoma City. And she told me that I needed to report to her office at 3 o'clock. I showed up at 3 o'clock to report. Every time she's ever called asking to report, I've reported. When I got there was an FBI agent there. There was another gentleman that's with the. He was a police officer, but he was detached as a special agent for the FBI.
An Oklahoma City police officer.
No, he was out of some other city.
You don't remember?
I'm not sure what city it was. He was a
I didn't know they
detective
did
from another
have you,
city.
Have you had that experience before?
No. And when I got in there, I started getting the riot act by them, talking about a phone call that I had made to the Russian embassy about a plot against the Russian president's life. And
do you remember what these voices said the attack would be or where it would be or anything?
The voices I heard was talking about... people I heard saying that they had somebody inside of Russia, close to the Russian president, that was going to help take him out. And I even said a day on it.
Now, I want to jump forward here for a moment, and I'm going to come back to this.
Okay.
But when the bridge collapsed on I-40 at 7:08 or something like that in the morning.
7:09.
Well, it was close.
Yes.
How come you know? How do you know it's 709?
Because of the fact that there was a gentleman that was actually videotaping the crash, the bridge site.
Oh, really?
Yes, they actually have footage of the collapse.
Did you talk to him?
Yes, I did.
He was just somebody there taking pictures?
Well, he was out there with his family, staying in a house at the riverfront.
Now you pulled over to that rest stop before you get to that bridge. You told me one time when
yes.
we were talking, and you talked to several of our producers along the way as well. And we've pretty well investigated the story a lot from your standpoint and what you've had to say and what other people say. Why did you pull over to that rest stop? You said, I think you told Adam in Oklahoma City that you felt uneasy or something that day.
You know when you have that sixth sense about something, you have that feeling that something was happening. And that's what I had. I had that feeling just to pull over. This was at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Now, we're going to where you were going and why and all that in a minute. But
right.
You just had this feeling, and you've had this feeling before.
Mm-hmm. And 95% of the time, whenever I had that feeling, it's always occurred either immediately before.
Did you have any idea before they called you down to the parole officer at 3 o'clock in the afternoon that you'd called the Russian embassy?
No.
This was completely a shock to you.
Yeah.
You seem like you're reasonably ready to accept it is the reason I'm asking.
Well, I'm ready to accept it because of the fact that I know that I hear voices, and I know sometimes I black out.
Now, these voices, do they tell you to do things?
No, they don't really tell me.
I'm just serious.
They tell me to do anything. It's that they talk about things, and it's like suggestions and stuff of what's happening or whatnot. And I took it upon myself to make the phone call.
I mean, is it more like these voices are do you think it's a hunch, or do you? I mean, what do you make of it? Or do you?
Well, I make it kind of spooky, really. I've had dreams and stuff about stuff that's happened.
Do the dreams come true?
A lot of them does.
There are regular events that you probably wouldn't know about. I mean,
see,
I've known you. You've written me from federal prison. We've talked. You've talked to three of our producers at least.
Yes.
I feel like I know you pretty well, and you just don't seem like the type of guy that would know about Putin. It seems so far out.
Yeah.
Does it seem that way to you, too?
It does. The first time I really even heard the name was really when the FBI agent asked me about that. I had been off my medication for about 2 weeks. I was out.
Now, the reason you were off your medications is because you didn't have any money?
No, it was just that I had ran out of my medication, and the medical center, well, the med clinic in Oklahoma City where I got my medication, wouldn't give me an appointment for 3 weeks to get my medication refilled.
So, in other words, they're trying to hold you responsible on the official story that you don't have your medications, and they're the ones that wouldn't give it to you.
Well, it wasn't the feds that didn't give it
to
me.
Yeah, well, what kind of clinic is this?
It's a called North Rock.
And who runs it?
It's I guess it's a state-ran facility, county-ran.
How'd you find out about them?
Through the halfway house. They're the ones that got me my medication when I ran out of the halfway house.
Well, frankly, if the federal government recommended that or told you about it, then they're responsible.
Well, the halfway house is an independently owned and operated halfway house. They have a contract. They are
working under a government from the U.S.
Well, both state and
contract,
federal.
You know.
They have a contract with both the state and feds.
Yeah, right. In fact, I imagine your encounters with the federal prison system, you ran across a lot of privatization. You know, a lot of companies doing work for them. In other words,
with my little experience I've had with the feds, like the Oklahoma Halfway House in Oklahoma City, which is a private-owned
right.
facility, who has contracts with both state and federal prisons. But in this federal system, you don't really see any privatization there. Only thing you see that's really private is like Votech, Unicor. Unicor is a private company that.
What do they do? Train you for?
Well, Unicor is like they are corporation companies that manufacture filing cabinets. They do rebuild Humvees.
Federal prisoners do the work for this company.
Yes.
Okay. While they're behind bars.
Yes.
Behind the walls.
Yes.
We've talked enough about that. Basically, what we're saying is you don't remember making these calls. You don't remember a lot of these things. You've had incidents where, like, you're missing. You came up as a different person one time for a week and a half. Is that the only time that happened to you? Something like that? Where you?
Where I've ended up in jail under a different name or anything like that. Yeah,
you know, you had a big party or something. You didn't know what I'm talking about.
No, I've had instances before where I've ended up going from one place to another state
for no reason at all.
For no reason at all.
Why were you on the highway that morning?
I was actually on my way to Missouri,
and that's where you have relatives.
Yes, my grandmother, my sister, my nieces, and my uncles there.
And you go over to Arkansas and go up.
Yes,
from where you were, I guess you were either in New Mexico or California.
I started out in California from my mom's house, and I drove through New Mexico and Texas and came up.
You literally started 2 or 3 days before that, or a day or two?
More like a week and a half.
Uh-huh.
Took my time. I stopped at a ranch.
What made you decide that you wanted to go?
Well,
leave your mom at that point? I mean,
well, it's not that I was really leaving my mom. I was just, my grandmother is an older woman, and she always says that she wished that I was there, because I used to live with her. I used to stay there for a little while.
I mean, you know what I'm getting at, Billy. I mean, you didn't have a voice say, hey, you need to leave. Or
no.
Did you?
No.
Okay.
I just wanted to see my grandmother because...
We're going to take a break, and when we come right back, let's talk about that day.
Okay.
And what happened and how you got involved and what happened after that. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin. You're listening to Conspiracy Files. The Elvis Presley Story. A collector's item thought to be extinct until recently. Now, all 13 hours of this famous worldwide radio broadcast series, produced in the 70s by rock and roll legend Ron Jacobs from Watermark Productions and heard around the world and hosted by Wink Martindale, is now available on CD. Hear the complete story from the cradle to the grave, Elvis Presley. He was truly the king of rock and roll. The Elvis Presley Story is a collector's item with all of the music and the people who made Elvis the king of rock and roll. Order now. Limited time discount price, $39.95 plus $5.95 shipping. Don't miss the Elvis Presley Story, available to you exclusively through this radio offer. Order now the Elvis Presley Story. Hurry, supply is limited. It's now or never. William C. Clark is with us. And William, before the break, we said we'd talk about this this event. Let's start step by step, if you don't mind.
I don't mind.
You left Southern California to the desert. You got on I-40. You drove, I guess, on I-40 all the way to where the bridge incident happened, or did you take some detours?
Well, I drove from California to Arizona, to New Mexico, to Texas.
Now you had an 85 Mustang?
Yes.
Was that yours?
Yes, it was mine.
Was it tagged in New Mexico?
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, because the tags I had were paper plates. temporary tags.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want the tags to cost in California.
Yeah,
it's a lot more money than it is.
I lived in California,
right? And so I stayed in a motel and stuff in New Mexico for a couple of days, and I used the address for the motel.
One of our producers said you were in Las Cruces. Is that right?
Yeah, I drove through Las Cruces.
Okay, is that where you got the tag?
Actually, I got the tags in Albuquerque.
Okay. So he's on the ball.
Yes, he is.
Well, we're checking him.
Yeah. an 85 Mustang can't be smogged.
Yeah. So, okay. You were at the rest stop. You were in civilian clothes.
Yes, I was in my blue jeans, shirts, cowboy boots.
And how far is this rest stop from, for listeners around the world, from that bridge at Weber's Falls?
About six, 7 miles.
When you got back in your car and got back on the highway, had you realized something had happened?
Well, it was raining that day. And as I was driving, there was an exit for Weber Falls, the Weber Falls exit.
Mm-hmm.
And the highway was blocked off by a city police officer. And at that time, I knew something happened. And I stopped up there and I asked the officer, hey, what happened? He said, the bridge is down, the vehicles are in the water. I said, well, I've went through training with Red Cross and stuff for emergencies. And if y'all need some help, I'd be more than willing to volunteer. And he said for me to go up to the bridge site and talk to Captain Harris.
Is this Captain Harris with the Oklahoma Highway Patrol or what?
Yes, he was the so-called incident commander.
Okay.
Of the Highway Patrol that's in charge of that scene at that time.
Okay.
So he had me go on forward. So I drove up the highway to the bridge scene. There was probably 4 or 5 Highway Patrol cars there. This was at, I got there about 7:15, 7:20 in the morning. I got out of my car. Nobody was up on the bridge site, up in the bridge.
Bridge literally had just fallen in, right?
Yes.
I mean, you could see the edge of it where you were probably.
Actually, you couldn't.
Oh, you couldn't. Okay, it was on downways.
Well, no, because how the bridge is elevated, you couldn't really tell that the bridge was collapsed right there.
So that explains the reason people were driving right off into the water.
Correct. And so I went down the left side of the bank area from the highway going down to the river.
You walked down there?
Yes. And when I got down there, I actually went into the water. And I rescued 2 people from there. And as I brought...
So you got down there and you saw people in the water?
No, there was cars in the water. I seen highway patrolmen and stuff on the other side of the bridge area. On the brink area.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't even paying attention to them. I was just caring about trying to save people's lives.
Were people yelling or screaming, or are they all underwater?
It was all underwater. All the vehicles were underwater. I went into the water and stuff to see what I could do. And I heard thumping. Like someone's thumping on the window or on the hood, mm-hmm. on the top of the car or something.
So you already were an expert swimmer. You mentioned the Red Cross.
Yes, I'm in my travels around the world. I've learned how to scuba dive, surf. I've in Hawaii, everywhere.
So, did you literally see people inside these cars?
You couldn't see inside the vehicles because
it was really dark and muddy.
Well, yeah, it was muddy. The undercurrent was just ridiculous. You could probably see maybe 10, 12 inches in front of you, if you're lucky. And that's even if you had a mask on, a face mask. I didn't have face mask.
You didn't have anything, right?
No. And so I went just by noise and stuff and by the feel.
The water must have been cold.
Actually, it was probably about 40 degrees, 30, mm-hmm. 40 degrees. And so when I heard the thumping stuff, I was able to break the window And I got two people out of the vehicle. Got them up on shore. And
a man and a woman or a man?
No, it was a woman and a daughter.
Okay.
After I got them up on shore, the highway patrol was there and everything. And Captain Harris was there. And he refused to let me go back in the water to attempt to try and get anybody else out.
And what was his reasoning?
He said because the current was too strong. He said that he has experienced divers here, but nobody was in the water. I'm the only one that went in. He said if I wanted to help out, for me to go to the bridge site, to the docks in Weber Falls, to help secure the perimeter, to keep all the media and the civilians out of the area for just emergency personnel. I was like, fine. At least I was doing something.
Mm-hmm.
About maybe three and a half hours later, I seen the highway patrol and stuff just sitting on the shore. They haven't even went into the water yet.
So you're saying they didn't bother to go in the water for 3.5 hours? Or?
They didn't go in the water until probably about 6 to 8 hours later.
Hmm.
To even attempt it. Captain Harris of the Oklahoma Patrol, the incident commander, refused to let his men go in the water. He said due to, quote, in his own exact words, were the currents are too swift for his divers to go in. His divers are trained for emergency diving. They had scuba gear, they had their air tanks and everything in their vehicle. But he refused to let them go in.
About what time was it when you took the two people out of the car, 7:30, 7:45?
Between 7:45 and 8 o'clock.
Okay.
And
then you were ordered out of the water at that time?
Yes. I turned around and I went to Weber Falls to help secure the perimeter. Like I said.
Okay, now you were still in your civilian clothes.
Yes. Soaking wet, but I was still in my civilian clothes.
And you got in your car, got in your Mustang, and you drove down to Weber Falls.
No, actually, I took a boat from the bridge site.
And now when you say you took a boat, what do you mean? Somebody said, come on, get in the boat?
I hopped a ride with a fisherman. See, that morning, they was having a fishing tournament.
You're right. I remember
there at
that.
That site.
So fact, there were a couple of people that day.
Right, so there were literally between 40 to 70 boats in that area fishing in the tournament. So we had plenty of boats there.
So now were you still in the water when this fisherman let you in the boat?
No, I was already out of the water. I was on shore.
And what'd you say? Hey, can I get in?
I asked if I can get right over to the docks. Okay. And he said, yeah, no problem. So I rode over to the docks, left my car up there. And I had, there was a lady with the Red Cross that actually volunteered to go up to the bridge site and get my car and bring it down for me. Because I was helping out and stuff over there.
So somebody else went out to your car?
Yes.
You gave them your keys?
Yes.
Okay.
So she brought my car back. About 3.5 hours later, a fisherman came over. And he had a bag and stuff that had belongings in there. And there was the city police officer. There was a Muskogee County sheriff there that had taken inventory, taken possession of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked if I would help them tag it and stuff.
Now, you're still in civilian clothes.
Yes. I said, sure.
And what? These are just belongings of people?
Yeah, right, to help inventory and stuff, okay. And document it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a camera that was in my car.
Right.
And they didn't have nothing to actually photograph anything. So I told the sheriff, the deputy, that he can go out to my car and grab my camera, my disposable camera that I had there. So he went out to my car and stuff and got the camera and came in. We photographed everything, wrote out everything on belongings. And in those belongings, there was a briefcase that belonged to a Captain Andrew Clements of the United States Army.
So this is how you knew about the United States Army captain.
Yes.
You didn't know about him beforehand.
No.
There have been no voices tell you about the United States Army captain dying and that you just where I handed the stuff.
Now, yeah, it was.
This was like a briefcase. Did you open it?
Yes, we opened it. Me and the deputy sheriff and stuff.
They were all there. What was in it?
There were medical records, dental records for Captain Andrew Clements, his wife and four children.
No, nothing top secret.
No, and his travel orders and stuff. He was in transit.
From California.
To
the Pentagon, right?
To Virginia, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At that time, I got on my cell phone, and I contacted...
Now, were you in uniform at this point?
No.
Okay.
I contacted Fort Sill, Oklahoma, military police officer. I told them exactly what happened, and that I had these medical records and travel
records. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm just curious. How do you know these numbers? I mean, you call the operator and get information.
I called information.
Okay.
So I contacted them up, and they took my cell phone number, and they said that there'd be someone give me a call back. About 15 minutes later, I got a phone call back from a Lieutenant Colonel Sally from the Pentagon, from Casualty Assistance Office.
Well, that's pretty quick action.
Yes. She asked me if the body's been recovered and identified yet. I said, no, ma'am. No divers have been in the water yet. No bodies have even been recovered yet. And she asked me if I would mind staying there until the body's been recovered and identified, and let her know.
And then call the Pentagon back.
And then give her a call back. I said no.
This is on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, this was the first day of the incident.
And so we're talking about probably...
I got the phone call around, I'd say, about 1:30, 2 o'clock.
So mid-afternoon there in Washington.
Yes. About...
So this Lieutenant Colonel probably was the... officer of the day or something.
No, she's actually in charge of the notification of
next of kin.
For
so somebody had called her and she
Fort Sill contacted her.
Mm, okay.
10 minutes not 10 minutes later after I got a phone with her, I got a phone call from a Major Stevens of the Pentagon. As I guess that was one of his officers that he was reporting to, I'm not sure, asked me if the body's been recovered yet. I said no. He's like, well, do you mind staying there until the body's been recovered and identified?
So basically, he said the same thing the Lieutenant Colonel did.
Exactly. So I stayed there, and I went outside, and I still seen the highway patrol and stuff sitting on the site, on the shore,
drinking coffee and donuts. That Oklahoma Highway Patrol did nothing.
They didn't. I asked them how come they haven't gotten the water yet, and they said that the incident commander, Captain Harris, would not authorize them. Captain Harris had the dam shut down so that the water level could the water flow would slow down and also recede some before he allowed his divers to go in the water.
In your opinion, was the water dangerous and treacherous?
No. I turned around. I even told Captain Andrew Clements, Captain Harris of the Highway Patrol, that if he was worried about the current and stuff for his men, we have all these fishing boats there. It's not that hard to tie a safety line to his divers and attach them to the boats so that they won't get endangered.
Well, what's your opinion of this, Captain?
Personally?
Yeah, I mean...
he shouldn't... I don't feel like he should have been in high patrol. I don't feel that he should have been an incident commander.
Did you encounter him later? After all this is over?
No.
You've never heard or seen from him since?
No.
Okay.
4.5 hours later, after the initial bridge collapse, I talked to a guy named Mike with the... Emergency Management Services, and he said that Captain Harris hasn't contacted any federal agencies to get them on scene yet, and that he was trying to keep it in-house. And I had got mad because he wouldn't let his divers go in the water. He wouldn't do anything. I got mad. I put on a set of fatigues.
I want to get into that when we come right back. This is what, about 6 hours later?
Yes.
I have lots of questions to ask about that. First of all, everybody's seen you not in the Army fatigues. Then you show up in the Army fatigues. I guess it's got to find out. We'll be right back, folks. I'm Jerry Pippin. I would like to take this opportunity to talk to you about a vacation idea for this summer, or really any time, that is unique, different, and affordable. I'm talking about a tour of the Grand Canyon in a van with Marvelous Marv, the world-famous tour guide. Marvelous Marv has lived in the Grand Canyon area for well over 2 decades, and he will show you things that no other tour guide will, and all the while fill you in on the history and the mystery of the giant canyon itself. When you go on a tour with Marv, you get to see the best viewpoints and the best exhibits. He knows this canyon. He knows this area of Arizona. Now, on this page, there's a banner you can click on, and it will take you to Marv's website, where you can get all the answers about Marv and his Grand Canyon tour. This is a vacation you will treasure forever. Check it out, won't you? Marvelous Marv's Grand Canyon Tour. We're talking with William J. Clark, and what's the middle initial, J?
James.
And let's talk about why you decided to put the fatigues on, why you had the fatigues, the whole thing. You got upset because nobody, in your opinion, was doing anything to save anybody's life.
Exactly.
But by this time, 5 or 6 hours later, they're probably all dead anyway.
Well, it's not the point of that. See, there was 10 vehicles in the water. Six out of those 10 vehicles that were recovered from that water, all their windshields were rolled up. Windshields were intact. There was no breakages, except for the one vehicle out of the six that had the driver's side window busted out that I had done when I got the mother and daughter out. So those people died a slow, agonizing death. Those people could have survived in between 3 to 5 hours in that vehicle, because it's like turning, if you get a cup and you turn it upside down, you stick it in a sink full of water, you're going to have an air gap in the top of that glass from the pressure of the water. And that air gap's going to stay there for so long. In a vehicle, you're going to have an air gap between 18 to 36 inches. So between a foot to 2.5 feet.
Okay, now, a lot of attention's been focused on this Army captain that was deceased. And we talked a little bit about that, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But was it your idea to put on the uniform?
Yes, it was. I got mad. I seen that nobody was doing their job, and they didn't want to take anything serious. And the uniform I had, I was doing stuff for the ROTC in California, my old school that I went to. And so I had.
When was that?
That was just a couple weeks prior.
Doing stuff with the ROTC, like what do you mean?
Well, they had a, a drill that they had, like state competition. All the different schools within the region would meet at the base over in Long
this
Beach.
This was your uniform?
Yeah, it was just a set of fatigues that had my name on it and stuff, and ROTC.
What kind of rank did it have on it?
It had captain bars. And it had unit patches and stuff. So,
well, now this ROTC unit, where was this?
It was out of 29 Palms, California.
Okay.
And so, but I had military unit patches on. So, and the unit patches were out of Fort Carson, Colorado, because I had a lot of friends. I still have a lot of friends there with Special Forces.
Yeah.
I even got tattoos with them and stuff, so I even have my own Special Forces tattoo.
Did you ever try to join the Army?
Yes.
What happened?
They wouldn't let me because of my feet.
Your teeth?
No, feet.
Feet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm sorry about that. I get that.
But one thing about it is I grew up military.
That's the reason I was asking.
Yeah, it's like my whole life.
So obviously you knew how a captain should behave.
Exactly. But like I said, I got frustrated. I put on my uniform and I said that my name was Captain Clark, United States Army 10 Special Forces. I was hereby taken over. I got on my phone.
You had a Special Forces patch?
Yes. I got on my cell phone. I contacted the NTSB, which is the National Transportation Safety Board. I contacted the Corps of Engineers.
You mean they didn't know anything about it?
No.
The state of Oklahoma hadn't told them?
Exactly.
They hadn't turned the television on and watched CNN. It was all over the place.
CNN didn't even get notified until probably about 4 or 5 hours later. No news media was even there.
Well, I saw it on CNN that morning.
Right. But it wasn't until almost 11 o'clock in the morning when CNN...
It was earlier than that.
Okay.
But the point is, they told you they didn't know anything about it.
Exactly. So the NTSB, I contacted them, the Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guards. I even contacted the FBI, and I got them all on scene.
And you told them, this is Captain Clark?
I said, my name is Captain Clark. I'm here at the Weber Falls Bridge collapse, the I-40 bridge collapse. And they're like...
Okay, now what about the people that you had seen earlier when you were in your jeans... Now, all of a sudden, you're in a captain's uniform. Anybody recognize you from earlier?
Yeah.
What'd they say?
They didn't say anything. They was just glad that somebody would step up to the plate and say, hey.
So, in other words, you're saying nobody was in charge.
Nobody wanted to be in charge. They didn't want to have that responsibility at their feet.
How about the local people in Weber Falls? They didn't?
The mayor of Weber Falls turned around and even told the news media that I was in charge. And I helped set up contact line where they could contact there if they thought that.
So you really feel, even though you were being an imposter, you actually were doing some good.
Exactly. I even have a letter here in my wallet, which I even sent you a copy of.
Yes, uh-huh.
From a chaplain here in Oklahoma that was at the bridge scene. And he even said flat out that it wasn't the fact that I said that I was a captain of the military, it's just the fact that these federal agencies
right.
were there, that nobody wanted to take charge.
Nobody was taking the lead.
Exactly, and that's now, what I now, did when I said that I was a captain and everybody...
If I remember correctly, some real Army officers in the National Guard, I think it was a major, somebody came across you, right?
No.
No? A captain? You didn't run across any official Army people that took orders from you?
There was a sergeant and a corporal there.
No officers?
No officers. The only officers that showed up was from the Corps of Engineers, and that was a colonel who was at the bridge scene. And then there was Coast Guard who actually set up site, their own little shop.
How long were you out there in the boat? Were you ever on a boat in the uniform?
Yes, I was.
Okay, so
you
literally took command.
Yeah, along with an FBI agent and Highway Patrol.
Did the FBI agent question you? I mean, like, who are you?
No. They didn't ask for identification or anything.
You know where this FBI guy was? Was he from Muskogee?
No, he wasn't from Muskogee. He was from Oklahoma, I think Tulsa or something.
Okay. And you more or less had unchallenged authority at this point.
Exactly. Nobody challenged my authority at all.
And you were getting calls from the Pentagon.
Yeah. And I was... The governor of Oklahoma himself shook my hand on TV.
I want to talk about that when we come back. Governor Keating, I understood that you actually told Governor Keating he couldn't have a press conference at a certain location. Is that right?
Actually, it is. He wanted to
admire you for your chutzpah.
Well... He wanted to have a press conference there at the bridge scene collapse area, and
the governor has official people with him. He has people from the Oklahoma National Guard with him, doesn't he? Or is it just state police?
State police.
Okay.
But one thing about it is that the governor, even though the governor is the governor of Oklahoma, that bridge collapse area is actually federal. It's actually... falls under the National Transportation Safety Board, which is actually a federal agency, and therefore falls under federal jurisdiction.
Now, when you were giving these orders, and the governor even was beginning to follow them. That had to feel pretty good. I mean, were you more in a mindset that you were just trying? Nobody else was doing it, so you had to do it.
Yeah, I didn't. It's not that I liked giving all these orders. My main objective was trying to save lives. All right, I try to get them to get divers in the water, but they wouldn't do it. This Captain Harris wouldn't let his people do it. So, in all reality, they're really at fault. This Captain Harris should have been went to prison too. He let those people die. In other words, it's basically population control. Take 9/11 for instance. Okay, the federal government knew a year before it even happened. They knew the date that it was going to happen. There was even a big Senate Oversight Committee on it, where the Central Intelligence Agency even admitted that they had information that was given to them a year prior. Even 6 months prior, they even had more information given to them.
Speaking of conspiracies, did you know there was a nuclear waste dump right across the river there?
No.
Did you ever know that during the whole time you were there?
No.
Did you ever meet that tugboat captain? The one that ran into the pier?
You mean the one that had alcohol yeah. on his breath? But the state said
the
that,
one that ran into the in the bridge.
Right. The one that was actually the
Did you meet him?
No, I didn't personally meet him.
Okay. So you don't know if he had alcohol on his breath or not?
Oh, I know he had alcohol on his
breath.
Well,
if you didn't meet him, how do you know?
Because the EMT, one of the ambulance drivers, even said that. And turned around, and the state highway patrol said they was just saying
would it surprise
that he just
you?
Fell asleep at the controls. And as he fell asleep, he hit the throttle on the tugboat, and he lost. And the boat just veered mysteriously to the right and hit the non-supported beam.
Would it surprise you if I told you that this tugboat captain had heard voices?
I wouldn't doubt it. The guy said that he hasn't slept in so many hours.
Oh, I don't know if he heard voices to say run into the the bridge. I'm just talking about in his history. He's heard voices.
I don't know.
Came out in court.
I know that they didn't charge him with
anything. Of course, you know, when things come out in court, you at first-hand experience, not much comes out in court.
Exactly.
It's pretty well controlled tightly in the federal system, especially by the judge and the federal prosecutor.
Yeah. And one thing about it is the federal system is so out of whack, the federal court system. You get more time for drugs or anything else than you do for rape, murder, or anything. I know there was in one of my prisons I was in, my federal prisons I was at, the guy was in there for, it was voluntary manslaughter, and he only got 5 years. Guy is also in there for possession of drugs, and he got 27 years.
I used to do a comedy routine like that, four guys in prison, one guy 5 years for manslaughter, 7 years for rape. 9 years for robbery, 26 years for stealing cable. You know?
Well, yeah, it's like the federal. See, personally, I think. See, there was an article that me and this other guy did in prison that we actually wrote up. I've been trying to find it, but I can't find it, so I'm going to have to try and get in touch with him when he can send me a copy of it. And it talks about a way to help change the federal. To change the system, period. For every convicted felon. They have at least 2 to 4 relatives, family members or whatnot, that are voters. And every one of them people knows voters. And the chain, if they go in there and they say, well, we ain't doing this anymore. We're not taking this anymore. And they pass that along. You're looking at 200 million voters in that racket alone. You're looking at because there's over 267,000 federal prisoners, federal inmates. It don't matter if they're on probation or parole or if they're actually in federal prison. That's in the federal system, period. That are in federal prison, and roughly 240,000 of those inmates are nonviolent offenders. You get more time for nonviolent than you do for being violent. The federal courts and stuff, and the Senate, and these senators and congressmen and stuff are saying, foul, foul, foul. Okay? They're talking about budget, money, and everything else. They're talking about this immigration bill where they want to spend millions and millions of dollars. Well, heck. What's the whole ideal of having a federal prison system and throwing people in prison, federal prison, for nonviolent offenders when they can turn around and instead of making them a liability, help them become a productive citizen?
You know, they kind of let you out of the system. And you don't get much help, do you?
I didn't get any help.
Do they give you any money at all when you get out of prison?
No.
You're just there, huh?
Exactly. See, the federal prison system, they're supposed to give you so much money and stuff, but they can give you up to $500. Okay?
They didn't give me
nothing.
$500?
No, they didn't give me anything. They didn't give me 1 cent. And that's because it's up. They leave that decision up to the warden of that prison. Instead of having it mandatory that each federal inmate that gets out of prison be given so much money. All depends on how much time they do in federal prison. Well, the wardens can say, no, I'm not giving them nothing. And they get away with it.
Let's get back to the situation there on the I-40 with the bridge collapsing and the deaths and the, as I alluded to, the nuclear waste dump right across the river. Be a good time to go get a few barrels of radioactive material, wouldn't it, Billy?
Yeah.
You didn't see anybody loading a truck up, did you?
No.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment. I'm Jerry Pippin.
The year was 1970 when Jack Blanchard and Misty Morgan released their first big single hit, Tennessee Birdwalk. For the first time in the history of music, this 45 RPM single becomes available to the public in the form of a mouse pad. Made of high-quality quarter-inch rubber, this fabric-covered 8-inch mouse pad delivers your mouse a very smooth ride. For only $9.95 plus $2.50 shipping and handling, your mouse pad will be rushed via USPS first-class mail. Simply click on the happy little mice and be directed to our ordering page. Hurry while this limited time offer lasts.
William J. Clark is our guest. And I'm Jerry Pippin, and he is the I guess you're the only person convicted in that whole thing that went to did a hard time.
Yeah.
As far as I know. And why do you think they chose you? An easy target or just to keep you quiet or what?
No, when I got sentenced, they said that I made the local, state, and federal government look like a fool. Because of the fact that...
Well, maybe they should all go to jail instead of you.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Teach them a lesson.
So I went to Tulsa with the medical examiner. You didn't run off as a fugitive.
No. When I left there, I was not a fugitive.
So we're talking about William J. Clark, and you were in charge basically for most of 3.5 days, if not all of it, huh?
Yes, that's correct.
Nobody showed up and said, we're taking over?
No.
Who are you? Where are your orders?
No, nothing.
Don't you? There's a lot of unanswered questions here, which you wouldn't have the ability to know about either. But when we're talking about this, this whole incident happens right across from a nuclear waste dump. You have a major Homeland Security initiative trying to stop from dirty bombs happening. Seems to me this would be a perfect opportunity for somebody to go get a little extra uranium. It wasn't even guarded over there. It was pandemonium where you were, right?
Oh, yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah, we had police officers and stuff from both Arkansas and Oklahoma there. Arkansas state troopers were over there.
Where did you sleep during those 3 days? You stayed there at the... do you have a cot or something?
No, I stayed there on... Well, they have a couch and stuff there in the... it was City Hall, basically. The... at Weber Falls, at the riverfront, that building there is also City Hall, too. So they had a pool table there, couch, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And me and the two National Guard soldiers, we all stayed there together.
These National Guard soldiers were from where?
They was from Oklahoma.
Uh-huh. And the enlisted men?
Yes.
Were they assigned there, or they just
volunteered? No, they volunteered. They volunteered, just like I did. When I first got there, I volunteered. And then after I got frustrated and stuff, and I put on my uniform, and they showed up after that happened, though.
So you told the governor he couldn't have his press conference, and he went someplace and had it.
He had it at the truck stop.
Then he left. That's kind of symptomatic of this whole situation. It seems to me like everybody was just looking for a photo op and then getting the hell out of there.
Basically. We even had, I think it was either a senator or the congressman for Oklahoma that even came there and stuff. And he shook my hand. He was saying, I was doing a great job. Keep it up.
You don't remember who he is, huh? He just said, you're doing a great job and keep it up.
No, I don't. I forgot his name. I probably know it if I heard it.
When did you decide to leave? Why did you decide to leave?
Everything was done. The Corps of Engineers and stuff, Coast Guard, got the last vehicle out of the water. I went to Tulsa with the Highway Patrol.
You rode up there in the car?
I rode up there with them in their car to the State Medical Examiner's Office with the medical records and dental records for Captain Andrew Clements, because the body's been recovered, and they had to do identification purposes so that I can contact the Pentagon.
So did you call the Pentagon back?
I contacted the Pentagon, said the body's been recovered and identified. They, in turn...
I kept hearing a story about a laptop. You know nothing about that laptop?
No, there was no laptop that was recovered.
I wonder how that got in the news, the mysterious laptop. For its conspiracy shows, that was a great deal, and nothing to it, huh?
See, that's just like when I got sentenced and stuff, there was a letter there from Captain Andrew's wife, Clement's wife, talking about they had a little safe, that they had a safe that was in the van that her husband was driving, and it had coins in there, and it had different stuff. And that the vehicle was flattened. I'm saying literally flattened. And like I said, the only...
You didn't get the gold coins?
I didn't get nothing. Only thing that... Only
you think
thing,
some fishermen might have got them?
No. Personally, I think probably the highway patrolman or someone did when the vehicles were recovered.
Mm-hmm.
Because the safe wouldn't float on top of the water. It would sink. And they brought when the vehicles were actually brought up on shore, it was state troopers and stuff that actually was going through all the vehicles.
No one at the Pentagon said, how about the valuables? Just his wife did, though.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, now I've got to ask you, what's the story about you going over to Van Buren and renting a motel? Yeah, what's the deal on that? If the story I heard is you put the little do not disturb signs on 10 empty rooms and you went to sleep.
No. What happened was I stopped at the motel. This was after everything was over with. And I got me a motel room for the night. And turned around and I was like, would y'all have any...
Did you use your Army identity to get the motel room?
No, I paid cash.
You paid money for it?
Yes, I paid money for it, which I even... Which, when I got arrested and stuff, and I went to court, it even shows on the whole, on my discovery that the that my attorney had gotten. It showed my receipt where I paid for my room.
So they didn't charge you for anything there? There was nothing to charge you?
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. What happened was that I had asked them, because this was a couple of days after the bridge collapse actually happened. And I went over there and stuff because of the fact that the Home Depot there actually donated some generators and lights for us. So I went there and to pick up that, and I brought them back. So I stayed at the motel, and I asked them if they had any rooms because we had the Coast Guard there now, Corps of Engineers, the NTSB, and all the motels in that area was booked, was solid, because of the fact that all these emergency personnel right. and stuff were getting rooms. And they said, yeah, we have probably about 9-10 rooms left. I said, well, great. I'll give them your number and stuff. I'll tell them that you have rooms. That way they can call you guys. And they said, great. So.
Did you give the number to the anybody?
Yeah, or? I gave the number and stuff to the NTSB agent and also to the the Corps of Engineers colonel and also to a lieutenant commander with the Coast Guard. And later on after that, when I got there, I got arrested, they said that... I had got 10 rooms, didn't pay for any of them.
Now, you know, during the time, William, I was following you as best we could. We didn't know nothing about you, really, too much.
Right.
You know, I even called your uncle and somebody you hadn't seen for a long time, but it's all on the website. There's a matter of record, but... It sounds pretty suspicious. You go over to this motel, and the next thing you know, you got a truck, and I want to get into this in a minute, the truck. I want to hear the real story on this. Next thing I know, you're in Canada. It sounds to me like, when we do these conspiracy shows, it sounds like, you know, you were doing some dirty work there for somebody, maybe for Uncle Sam. How'd this truck thing come about? You went over to what, Truman Baker Dodge or something like that?
Yes. What happened was I went over there. And
now, that's on the way up to your grandma's house.
Exactly.
That's on the highway.
Exactly. I was having problems with my Mustang. And I had told him that I just got done at the bridge site and everything. I even showed him the video clips I had of it, and which I had showed you, which I had given you the tape.
Yeah.
And... They turned around, they gave me a loaner truck.
Because the Mustang had trouble?
Right.
Okay.
So
you didn't steal a truck, they
no,
gave
I,
it to
I
you.
Didn't steal a truck, I had it as a loaner. They even gave me the paperwork on it showing it's a loaner truck. And they said I could use it for 30 days. And stuff. So.
They said you could have the truck for 30 days?
Exactly.
Was that on the paperwork?
Yeah, it was actually on the paperwork.
Okay.
And
why did you end up in Canada?
Well, I turned around and I went up there and stuff because...
You've been up there before.
Yeah, I've been to Canada before. I've been to Canada...
I mean, you've been this place, this island before, right?
No.
Oh, you hadn't?
No. No, I turned around and I actually seen a thing in a magazine for camping and fishing and stuff like that. And I was like, heck, I could use me a few days there. So, after what I've been through and stuff, and the bodies I've seen and stuff at the riverfront, I needed a little...
Yeah, you needed a vacation.
Exactly.
It came up rather nefarious sounding that you had a weapon.
Well, yeah,
What's the deal on that?
It was a lever-action 30-30 rifle.
And you use it to deer hunt or something?
Well, what it was the ranch I was at.
Why did you have it?
The ranch that I was at visiting here in Oklahoma had a lot of rattlesnakes.
Okay.
So
where was that?
Watumpka,
Wauwiko, someplace like that?
I forgot the name of it. I had met him and stuff.
So it wasn't your gun?
Oh, it was my gun. I purchased it here in Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
And
do you have to have a record or a certificate or something for that sort of
stuff?
Yeah,
I bought it at a pawn shop. The guy asked me for my identification and stuff, and he said, just sign the paper, So I signed it.
Okay.
And he called it in, got the authorization, and I got the gun, and that was it, the rifle. When I got arrested in Oklahoma, I mean Canada, the rifle...
Now, you went over to this island, and what you have to take a ferry over there, and you put your truck on the...
Right, I put my truck on the ferry, went across, come back to get some supplies the next day.
You had a cabin or something over there, or what?
No. Just, it was a little campsite, that's all.
Okay.
Sleep under the stars. And
are you a hunter?
I've done hunting one time.
Okay.
And so I stayed at a motel that night, and the next morning I was going to take the ferry back across. And
what's the name of this town? Do you remember?
I forgot the name of it. I was going to South Baymouth, Ontario.
Okay.
Which is the island. And so I was in line to go to get on the ferry. And next thing you know, I get surrounded by the RCMP and the OPP, the Ontario Provincial Police.
Do they wear red coats?
No.
Okay. Did that not like Sergeant Preston?
No, it's not like Sergeant Preston or Dudley Do-Right.
Okay.
And they had all their weapons drawn on me and stuff. And at first I asked them what was going on and stuff. They said that I had a stolen vehicle. I said, no, it's not. Here's the paperwork for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, no, they said it was a matter of national security.
Oh, really?
Right. And they said that the FBI had me red flagged. So they arrested me.
Did you realize at this point that they were talking about you being an imposter and
no.
all of this?
No.
No. Okay.
Once I got taken to the jail, they said that... that the FBI had me red flagged for questioning with regards to the I-40 bridge collapse. That was the only thing it was for, questioning. I stayed there for 10 days because in Canada it's against the law to have a firearm there, period, unless you're law enforcement or military in their country.
Did you know that before you went up there?
No. And I actually had it right there when I went through the checkpoint to the border. And the agent there at the border even saw the rifle, and they didn't say nothing about it. So I stayed there in the jail for 10 days. I got taken to...
What kind of jail is it in Canada? Is it better or worse than the U.S.?
In all realities,
better. Yeah. Better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
you were in jail in North Dakota once. Something, and I'm not bringing up previous records to make you look bad. But here again, you got to look at it from my standpoint. We're talking about a guy who calls Putin or the embassy and reports him. You're next to a nuclear waste dump and you take charge. You're up in Canada. It's a matter of national security. They pick you up. You know what's happening in the Dakotas, don't you? That's where our nuclear weapons are stored, a lot of them. But you're just saying all this is happenstance. Let's get back to the real story here. They brought you back to Muskogee?
Yes. Well, actually, I brought myself back.
Oh, really?
I drove myself back from
they
Oklahoma City.
They told you just to turn yourself in here or what?
Well, after I was arrested in Oklahoma City, the judge released my own.
Well, no, I'm talking about from Canada.
No, they flew me back from Canada.
Yeah, okay.
They took me from Canada. They drove me from Canada to the Vancouver-Canada border and turned me over to the FBI there. And the FBI took me into New York to the federal building and stuff. I seen the judge there. I waived extradition. I was in the county jail there for like 3 days. And then the U.S. Marshals picked me up on Con Air.
Yeah. So anyway, they basically brought you back to face prison, which they sentenced you ultimately because you had a plea bargain?
Well, I didn't plea bargain.
Well, you pleaded guilty.
Well, I pleaded guilty because...
On the advice of your attorney? Or
on the advice of my attorney. Well, I knew I was guilty because of the fact that I knew what I did was wrong. But the reason why I did it was to try and save lives because nobody else was trying to do anything.
Nobody gave you any sympathy on that?
No. When I got sentenced, because I'd given an interview to a newspaper, and they took away my acceptance responsibility. See, in the federal system, when you go, they have a point system, your levels. And if you accept responsibility, they reduce your levels by 2 or 3 levels. All depends on how high your level is. So with my acceptance responsibility, I would have only gotten 33 to 41 months.
You're talking about sentence guidelines,
right,
basically.
Exactly, sentencing guidelines.
Now, the judge, Jim Payne here, sent you for more than that.
Gave me 70 months.
But
Why? He said that I didn't accept responsibility because of my reluctance with the news media trying to justify my actions, which I wasn't trying to justify them. I was just explaining to them why I did what I did. I accept the responsibility. I pled guilty. All right. I didn't have the federal government ask me, making me any deal. I pled open to the judge.
And they're still threatening to send you back to jail now.
Yes, I have.
You may end up going back in front of Judge Payne.
Well, I will have to go back in front of Judge Payne. And unless
ponder that in a moment, we'll be back to wrap this up. Don't go away. I'm Jerry Pippin. We're talking with William J. Clark.
Let me talk to you about UFOTV.com for a minute. UFOTV offers not only the best selection in the world when it comes to conspiracy and UFO subjects. We're talking DVDs, magazines, books, video on demand, and movie downloads. All available worldwide exclusively at UFOTV.com. The largest selection of exotic and suppressed DVDs, books, and magazines on the Internet. Go to the website UFOTV.com and sign up for the free color catalog or call this toll-free number, 1-800-350-4639. Stay tuned. Now, later in the show, we will be telling you more about UFOTV. It's the way to shop for quality UFO and conspiracy products in the 21st century. Get your free catalog now at UFOTV.com or 1-800-350-4639.
We've pretty well followed what I wanted to talk about, William Clark. You sure you're not an agent?
I'm positive about that.
I had to give up on that premise once they have sentenced you to some hard time. That's not much of a reward, would it be?
No.
It's almost you pretty well are here testifying in front of me and the worldwide audience that idea of putting the Army uniform on was yours. Nobody taught you into that.
Yeah, I admit that. Nobody talked me into it. I did it because...
Nobody suggested it?
No.
Okay.
There was one guy that was with the Emergency Management Services says that he wished that somebody was here that would step up and take charge because nobody else wanted to. And I got frustrated. Nobody was doing anything, and that's when I put on that uniform. I said,
and you had no idea this nuclear dump was near there?
No.
Anybody ever mentioned that to you in the 3 days this stuff was going on?
Actually, no, they didn't.
You would think that'd be one of the first... That's the first thing I thought of that morning at 8:35 when I found out about it.
Well, one thing...
I wish I could get down... In fact, I told our producer, Roberta Scott, that morning. I said, maybe we need to get in the car and go down and see if anybody's over there at the nuclear waste dump. They may be loading barrels up right now. It'd be a good time to do it.
I wouldn't doubt it, because yeah. I know...
It was totally disorganized, is what you're
exactly.
telling me.
See,
it was pandemonium.
See, the United States government, I'm going to let you know a little secret about the United States government.
Okay, I like this.
Okay.
I'm for secrets.
The United States military has all these different forms. They have these identification cards and stuff, which are manufactured very easily. A 2-year-old... could do it. You got all these terrorists, Bin Laden, all of them, that can get onto any military base within the United States, around the world. and walk off that base with ammunition, weapons, explosives, the whole nine yards. Because of the fact that the government ain't running it like they should be running it.
You're saying nobody's doing their job. And
exactly.
And we still haven't figured
out.
Let's
put it this way. A friend of mine at Fort Carson, Colorado, actually got me a military identification card. All right, issued it to me. Even put me in the computer. So that I could have it where I can go onto the base store, to the base PX and stuff, and I can buy food, my cigarettes, tax-free.
Well, that's the reason I say if a real terrorist that wanted to do us in, they could have done it a long time ago. It wouldn't take much to just get a hold of a gasoline truck and drive it into a nuclear power plant or a refinery.
Yeah, that's true. Nuclear power plants have automatic weapons, which they could stop the truck before it got there. But it's not that. But in our reality, if a terrorist wanted to do anything, it wouldn't be that hard to do it. All it would take is a law rocket.
What do you hope to accomplish here, besides giving your side of the story? You want to wake people up that people aren't doing their jobs, or what's the problem here at the federal government? In the state government, we're talking about the Oklahoma Highway Patrol didn't do their job. We're talking about a lot of people didn't do their job.
Exactly. See, all these agencies, they feel that they're above everybody. Me, I'm only a little peon, all right? Sure, I know a lot about the world. I know a lot about criminal activity. Sure, I'm not a choir boy. Okay, I've had my run-ins with the law. With police and everything else. But the only way that
you're not predisposed to be a crook at this point. You're working hard. You
exactly.
got a job.
Exactly. I got me a job. Okay. I got me a place to live and stuff. And I'm doing good.
Okay.
And I was doing good up until the bridge collapse,
which right? was and none of your
and
doing.
The only reason that I even got caught over this was because of the fact that the governor wanted to thank all the emergency workers and stuff and have this memorial banquet dinner. And he contacted the feds to get in touch with the military.
They wanted to get Captain Clark back.
They wanted to have me and these National Guardsmen and stuff and all these other people show up. So when the feds contacted Military Records St. Louis up, they said, "We're sorry, but there is no such person as a Captain William J. Clark."
There's one of two scenarios here. Either everybody was had and they're just trying to get even with you, or the other scenario is somebody's trying to cover something up and you're a good fall guy.
Exactly.
I wonder which one it is.
I think it's the later.
Oh, really? You think you're a fall guy?
Personally, yeah. Because of the fact that, one, the judge and the prosecutor knew one of the victims of the bridge site. They should have never handled my case in the first place.
You know the problem I have, William, is not with you. It's with how did the Associated Press know you called the Russian embassy? You didn't tell them.
No, but it was made public record in court.
You think the reporters are that smart to check the... I think somebody tipped them off. I'm going to talk to the AP and find
out. One thing about your conspiracy theory, and this is why I'm thinking this, is because within the past 45 days, the Secret Service has contacted my family twice, asking them about me and my affiliations, if I'm a threat to the United States President or anything like that. They're asking all these different questions. And for them to get involved with something like that, there has to be a bigger picture than just my own little puny self.
It goes back to you hearing voices.
Yeah.
And I would like to call attention to
the program
the federal government uses on people like William Clark. I'm not saying that they did with you.
Maybe they did when I was stabbed in the head when I was about 6 years old.
Really? How did that happen?
Well, my sister actually got mad at me and...
A family quarrel that went bad.
In the pickup truck in Texas after I was kidnapped.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tonight, as we do the show, William J. Clark is back in jail. Judge James Payne revoked his parole and sentenced him back to prison, to the federal system. I know Clark very well by now. We have been in acquaintance with him by letter, email, telephone calls, and personal visits for some time. It all started while he was still in prison in Victorville, California. Not only myself, but many of our producers have had personal contact with Clark. Clark seems to me to be anything but a dangerous person. It's kind of interesting, in many ways, this show did not turn out the way we thought it would. When we originally started trying to make overtures to Clark, we were pretty convinced that the participants in this episode concerning the I-40 bridge collapse back in 2002 next to a nuclear waste dump just a few miles across the river, there had to be some sort of connection. Then there was that Army captain, too, who mysteriously died in the plunge into the deep river. And Clark recovered the briefcase. There was some question about whether or not there was actually a laptop computer. As you heard Billy Clark say, there wasn't. We don't know. We have to take his word for it. The authorities never really have said. We have many questions. Actually, more questions than answers. Evidently, according to Clark and others, it was hours before many of the cars were recovered. Why did the National Guard, the Highway Department, the Governor's Office here in Oklahoma, nationally, the Homeland Security people, and the Defense Department, even the Pentagon, allow a man who had no military record at all to take charge? Clark did not look like a Special Forces Army captain to me, nor did he look like that to many others. However, he was allowed to make decisions, get equipment, and generally run the entire recovery operation. He even at one time told Governor Keating where to have his photo op. Then there's the question of Clark going to Canada, and then the Mounties arresting him, and then him being brought back to Oklahoma, where they charged him, not with anything other than impersonating an Army officer. The record shows that no one died, no one was injured, no one stole any money, at least not from Clark, Clark's actions. Nobody charged that at all. But here we have a U.S. district judge, a federal judge, and a U.S. attorney's office throwing the book at a man, keeping him from talking to whom? Long as he's in jail, he won't be able to tell his story. And when he was out on parole, they watched him like a hawk. Is the system so corrupt that individuals in charge are so inefficient that they all have to work together just to cover up their ineptness? Or was it more serious? Linda Jensen has a book about mind control and murder and the bridge collapse. Could there be something to that? And how did this Putin story get into the mix? And even more strange to me is, how is that a violation of his parole? Clark was actually trying to report a coup, someone trying to assassinate a head of state. And now, tonight, he's in jail. Why would James Payne, the judge, sentence him to 21 months to keep him out of our way? So we can't ask him more questions? So what if Clark is just emotionally challenged? He has every right to be. When you examine his history, a mother who had many marriages, abusive stepfathers, a sister who actually stabbed him in the head when he was 6 years old. He was kidnapped somewhere along the way as well and held for ransom. And then he was arrested, put in a federal prison, and released without any money. And people daring him to make it. And when it began to appear that he might make it, he actually got a job as a cook. The judicial system went after him on this strange charge. So what do we have here? Is it a mind control operation? Did they pick Clark because he was a loser? Does it have something to do with the Army captain and the missing papers? Or are they missing it all?
How about that nuclear waste material? And Homeland Security always talking about dirty bombs. Doesn't seem like they've been doing a very good job of guarding that, do they? Either way, if it's a conspiracy or just a total tale of ineptness by many people, it's a story that leaves you soiled. I don't feel good about this story, and I don't know what to do about it. Thanks for listening. This is Jerry Pippin. Cheers.